upon ingratitude through that benevolence.
Thank you. So this may be familiar to some of you. This is one of the kind of the important mottos that we've taken in our Jodo Shinshu tradition. So to realize Shinjin, this word Shinjin is often translated as entrusting heart. Could also be translated as a kind of confidence. Older translations will use this word faith. And translations done by non-Jodo Shinshu Buddhists almost always use the word faith. And faith is an okay translation, I think, for this word Shinjin. The problem with faith is that many people think of faith and they immediately think, well, it's faith in something outside of yourself. It's faith in God, faith in something separate from me. Whereas this Shinjin that Shan Dao and later Shinran talk about is a faith in the teachings of the Buddha to guide me to my own realization. So it's a sense that you can trust the teachings, that what the Buddha taught is true, that although it may be difficult to follow at times, that if you really entrust yourself to the wisdom of these teachings, that you will indeed one day become a Buddha. It's being confident that I'm going to become Buddha by following these teachings. I'm not there yet. I know that I've got a lot of issues. I'm definitely not enlightened yet. But if I follow this path, if I embrace these teachings, then I will one day become a Buddha. I will one day realize perfect freedom from all suffering, sadness, disappointment, and so forth. And so Shan Dao composed these verses to express ideas like this. So this idea that to realize Shinjin, to realize this feeling of deep entrusting for oneself, and then to guide others along to that realization, that's very hard. It's hard to do, but if you're able to do that and to awaken all beings, so to help, kind of to have a spirit or an attitude of trying to help everybody, even the people you don't really like that much, that broad kind of open heart, that is how to respond to the great gift that we receive from the Buddha. So oftentimes you get something, you get a gift from somebody, and you think about, how am I going to repay this gift? How am I going to give them something back? This is really common, I think, especially in Japanese culture, right? There's this, like, gift wars. Somebody gives you something really nice, and then it's like, oh no, now I have to give them something really nice. There's this incredible weight of the, oh, I received this nice gift, or, osewa ni natta kara doushiyou. Like somebody helps you out a lot, and then, how am I ever going to be able to, repay that? And in reality, you can't. It's impossible. And particularly, Shan Dao says, the great gift that we receive from the Buddha. The Buddha gives us the great gift of really solving all our problems. If you really take this teaching and embrace it in your life, it solves all your problems. Because your problems become okay. It doesn't, if you have cancer, people will say to me, what if you have cancer? That's like the worst thing. I agree. But even if if you get cancer, it doesn't make the cancer go away. You can't come to the temple and, say Namo Amida Butsu 100 times and then, your cancer is going to disappear. But what you receive from this teaching is that that's okay. You can be okay with that. It's very difficult. You know, you can be angry, you can be depressed, you can be afraid, but all that anger and fear and depression, that can become okay in the Nembutsu. It becomes okay. Whatever my life is, including how I feel. You know, that doesn't mean that you have to like cancer. That doesn't mean you have to be happy about it. You can be angry and frustrated. But in the midst of that anger and frustration, you can say, okay, anger is fine. Frustration is fine. But I'm not going to let it carry me away. And that's the great resolution of difficulties that we receive from the teachings of the Buddha. And so, you know, we get this great gift of basically having all our problems solved. And so how could you possibly repay that to the Buddha, who lived 2,500 years ago? No way you can do something for the Buddha. He's in parinirvana. He's entered great tranquility. There's nothing you can do for him now at this point. And so the way in which to express your gratitude is to share that understanding, to share that benefit with others. That's Shandao's great insight. And that's the insight that serves as one of the real pillars of understanding in our Jodo Shinshu tradition. So that's kind of the doctrinal, the teachings itself. That's what the teachings say. Now, in terms of the Ojo Raisan, this teaching of Shandao's was embraced by a Japanese monk hundreds of years later named Honen. And Honen's here on the sheet as well. He's 1133 to 1212. Honen. So Honen, he really got this idea of Shandao's. He really understood this feeling that Shandao had that, you know, I've got issues, I've got hang-ups, I'm not able to be very zen about my problems. So I need a teaching that helps me just accept my life as it is, accept myself as I am, and for that to be a path to awakening. And so Honen really embraced this teaching of Shandao, that the teaching that the compassion of Amida Buddha is constantly working in our lives, providing us with this path to birth in the Pure Land, this path to enlightenment that we call birth in the Pure Land. So Honen really loved this teaching, he embraced this teaching, and so he started to share this teaching with people. People gathered in large numbers. They really, really liked what Honen had to say. Because up until that point, people had been saying, well, you know, if you're living as a fisherman, then you are in no way living a Buddhist life. You know, you're taking life as your occupation. And so there's no way, you have no chance of enlightenment. You know, you're going to have to go around the cycle a few more times or a few hundred more times before you can become free. And Honen is saying, no, no, Shandao shows us that in the Buddha's teachings, in the words of Shakyamuni, there is this path for people who have a real heavy burden of bad karma to become awakened. People heard this teaching and they thought, wow, this is great. I've never heard anybody talk about Buddhism in this way before. I've never heard anybody teach the Dharma in a way that sounds like they're speaking to me and my life and my circumstances. So so Honen developed this large gathering. Yes, David.
Excuse me. How did the teaching of Shandao jump this 500-year interval? Was it through the chanting handed down through generations? Was it written?
So it was, yes, I'm about to.
Okay.
Yeah. So Honen was known as a great scholar. He read the entire Buddhist canon, which is in Chinese translation now, fine print, fills up, if you laid the books like end to end. They're about this big, and if you put all the books end to end, they would fill one pew of fine print Chinese, very, very small. So Honen is said to have read that whole canon 5 times, searching. So he was reading this whole canon, all of this, so you can imagine a whole pew full of big telephone book sized volumes. He read the whole thing over 5 times, searching for the solution to this problem. He looked around him, he saw all these people who weren't able to, through various circumstances, practice difficult practices, make great donations to the temple, master the scriptures, study the scriptures in the way that he was. And he said, these people need a path too. We can't just leave everybody out who doesn't fit this one small mold. Because the true compassion of the Buddha is to provide a path for everyone. So there's got to be something in here, somewhere, in all of these scriptures that describes this path to awakening for everyone. And so as Shandao was reading through volumes and volumes, he came across Shandao's commentary on the Contemplation Sutra. So Honen, in his extensive reading, discovered Shandao's commentary, discovered the teachings of Shandao in his reading, and that was his big aha moment, reading Shandao's commentary on the Contemplation Sutra. He said, this is it! This is what I've been looking for. This teaching of Amida Buddha's great compassion for all beings. This is what I've been searching for. And so that's where he got, he started teaching this path to awakening for everybody. Yes?
Do we have an example of that actual reading that he read, or a scripture or verse that Honen read from Shandao's teaching? Is there a way of applying that particular?
Yes. Yes, yes. It's, this is, I don't know if that exact verse is available in English translation, but the teachings of Shandao, there's this Ojo Raisan, which contains Shandao's teachings, is available in English translation. I actually have a copy on the table in that room, so I welcome you to have a look at it, and I can help you find a copy if you'd like. A copy of yourself, of your own. Also, in the writings of Shinran and Honen, which are translated into English, there are quotations of, this passage here is quoted in the collected works of Shinran. So that's, this big blue book that we have, there's a copy of it out there, and this is widely available. This book contains a lot of quotations from Shandao, and it contains those, the same content, those quotations from the Contemplation Sutra and the commentary on the Contemplation Sutra is available here in the collected works of Shinran. And I can point you to those passages, gladly. Yes. Yes.
Yeah, one question. These large number of sutras, 84,000, I think, the number, are they accepted as definitive by all Buddhists in the world, or is there any some that just make selections out of them?
The canon that Honen had was the Chinese. The canon of scriptures in Chinese translation, and so and that's recognized. So Buddhists won't say, oh, these are real and these aren't. What they'll do is they'll kind of categorize teachings and say, these teachings are for these sort of people, these teachings are for these sort of people. That's a common practice, particularly in China, where all of the sutras came in at once in one kind of big clump. In India, they gradually developed over time, and these different traditions developed. However, Buddhism had already been developing for hundreds of years by the time it started to be imported into China. And so Chinese scholars, as all these sutras were coming in, like, wait a second, over here it says this, and over here it says something that's quite different, so how do we reconcile this? And so they came up with a system, particularly the Chinese Buddhist scholar Juri, who's the founder of the Tiantai or Tendai school. He came up with a system of saying the Buddha, over the course of his life, taught the teachings in stages. So he first taught the pure content of his enlightenment. Nobody got it. So then he took it right back down to like first grade, kindergarten Buddhism, and gradually worked his way up to the Lotus Sutra. That's Juri's interpretation. So there are, and different Buddhist schools will kind of organize differently that categorization.
Well, for example, are there some schools from the Theravada school that might not accept all of these?
Yes. I mean, I don't, you know, the Theravada monks I know personally have never, you know, sort of said, oh, what you guys do isn't real, or, you know, the Buddha never said that. That's not really in the kind of mentality of the Theravada Buddhists I know, but, you know, it's not beyond the possibility that someone could, you know, sort of, you know, we could all, I mean, if you really want to get into it from a kind of scholarly perspective, you know, we have no idea what the Buddha actually said. You know, there were no tape recorders back then, and, you know, the teachings were passed down in oral tradition for, you know, a couple hundred years before they were even written down for the first time. So, you know, I think it's, for most Buddhists that I know, practicing Buddhists, you know, what's being passed down is the truth of the teaching that is put into words for people to understand. And I think most Buddhists are able to recognize that that truth is present in the Theravada tradition, the Mahayana tradition, and depending on people's cultural circumstances, you know, where they grew up, their temperament, their mentality, that different teachings will speak to them in different ways. So if you grew up in Thailand, you know, odds are that Buddhism explained in Thai, in a kind of Theravadan cultural perspective, that's very, you know, Thai culture and Theravadan Buddhism are closely intertwined, there's a good chance that that's really going to connect with you. But, you know, perhaps, you know, maybe it won't, and maybe you'll come to a Jodo Shinshu temple and say, oh, hey, this is what is for me. And so it's, I think what's important from my perspective is not to get into a discussion of, you know, well, you know, is this a historically factual matter? Because it's, the Buddha sutras aren't really historical documents. They're an expression of religious truth. And so I think the way to think about that is this true? Is this telling me something that provides true meaning for my life? That's my perspective. So just to shift gears a little from the kind of doctrinal side, so what Honen had was, Honen really connected with this, the content of Shandao's teaching, and he shared that content very skillfully in a way that gathered a large community. And as that community gathered, they said, well, we need to do something. You know, we need to have some kind of a liturgy. All these other Buddhists are chanting, or, you know, they're doing something, and so we want to have some practice that we can do together, some chanting, some a way of expressing our joy, of sharing the teachings, of deepening our understanding. And so in Honen's community, the thing that caught on, that was chosen to do, was the chanting of Ojo Raisan. Shandao said, or Honen's community said, kind of as a group, said, this is what we're going to do. And this became their thing that they did, was chanting Ojo Raisan, and a very beautiful melody. So I'd like to introduce the melody that's been passed down in the Nishi Honganji. In our specific tradition, we receive a certain melody for chanting it. And if you go to a Jodo-shu temple that's also, so another temple that also sort of descends from Honen's community, they're going to have a different melody, a different, slightly different style of chanting. But this melodic chanting of the Ojo-rai-san, this is what really attracted people in many cases. You know, they're just kind of walking around and say, oh, we're going to go to, you know, Honen's group. Honen's got these great teachings and you got to hear the chanting. They're like, well, you know, I'm really not that interested in listening to some guy talk about something, but, you know, I like music. I'd like to hear what this sounds like. And so this was kind of a hook for people. They would go and they would hear it and they'd be like, wow, that's great. And they would want to keep going back to hear the chanting. And then in time, they would also hear the teachings and be connected with the Dharma in that way. And so just to kind of give you a little taste of this this Ojo-rai-san chanting, I thought I would share the way in which this passage, the English translation here, this is chanted. So they all begin with this this phrase, Namo Shishin Kimyo-rai, Saiho Amida Buddha. So I take refuge and sort of bow down in reverence to Amida Buddha in the Western Quarter. So there's this deep sense of reverence and gratitude towards Amida Buddha who provides this path to liberation. Namo traditionally chanted in a kind of call and response way. So the person who's leading would chant the first Namo Shishin Kimyo-rai, and everybody all together chants Saiho. So to give you a sort of sense of the volume, it would be like Namo Shishin Saiho. So it has this really kind of resonant back and forth, and kind of, you know, it's beautiful. It just kind of grabs you. And so people love this. This was, in many ways, my chanting instructor in Japan said that this was the big problem with Honen's community from the perspective of other schools of Buddhism. It's that it wasn't that they were... you know, it was the doctrinal thing too, but that they were basically including rock and roll in their services. You know, people heard this and they were like, oh my gosh, we just can't compete with, you know, this sort of melodious kind of rhythmical chanting that everybody could do. So, you know, at the time, and even to this day to some extent, you know, Buddhist chanting in many traditions is very kind of I don't want to use the word performance, but it's kind of like that in the sense that the priests are chanting and the participants are sitting and listening, but not actually doing the chanting, particularly the more melodious and kind of sophisticated styles of chanting. And so this was something that everybody could do together. And this is, you know, this is still a part of our kind of Pure Land Buddhist culture, Jodo Shinshu culture. We all chant together. You know, our main thing that we chant, the Shoshinge Wasan, we all chant that together as one. And so this was a huge kind of way of drawing in new people into this community, widely successful, and ultimately was one of the key things that led to the persecution of the Nembutsu community. Shindan, as you know, as I mentioned, pictured here to the right in the Onaijin, eventually, along with Honen and many of Honen's other disciples, was sent into exile. And there had been pressure from many of the leading groups up to that time, the other Buddhist groups, to kind of shut Honen down, basically. Saying, you know, he's teaching this crazy Nembutsu thing. You know, in other schools of Buddhism, they would say the Nembutsu. They would do Namo Amida Butsu. That was common in Tendai and Shingon and most of the other major Buddhist schools. But they would do other things too. They would meditate, they would do scripture study, they would do kind of esoteric rituals. And so they weren't saying, just do the Nembutsu. So Honen's idea that you can just say the Nembutsu and be saved by Amida Buddha, that was crazy talk as far as they were concerned. And they wanted it to stop. And but the emperor at the time was kind of like, you know, he's not really hurting anybody. You know, it's fine. You know, he's getting people to listen to the Dharma. I don't see a big problem with it. I don't want to get involved in this matter. Until one thing happened. So you see on the page one of this form, there are two people here, Andakubo and Jurenbo. These were two disciples of Honen, and they were wonderful. They had these amazing chanting voices, we're told. They were just these great, inspiring chanting voices. You know, they were like the Justin Bieber or something. The Justin Timberlake, you know, and the Usher or something like that of their time. They had these amazing voices, and people would just come to hear them chant. You know, and then through that, they would come to appreciate the Dharma. And so you have Andakubo and Jurenbo, these wonderful chanters. They have this, they chant this Ojo Raisan in a beautiful way. And there are two young women, a woman by the name of Matsumushi, who was 19 years old, and Suzumushi, who was 17 years old. And they hear this chanting, and they're like, I've got to find out more about this. So they go and they hear the chanting. They get kind of inspired by that. And then they go to hear Honen's teachings, and they say, "Oh, this is it. This is wonderful. We're women. Up until this point in our lives, we've been told that as a woman, you have no hope to become enlightened because the fact we're born as a woman is the result of such bad karma." And just being a woman is creating bad karma for you. So you're not going to be able to realize enlightenment. So you better, just hope for another few more go-arounds to get it right. And then hear Honen saying, no, actually, as a woman, through the working of Amida Buddha, you can realize enlightenment. At the end of this, this is your last go-around. You don't have to wait one more time. This can be it for you in terms of the world of suffering. You can end your ties to the world of suffering in this very lifetime. And so they say, oh, this is great. You know, we don't want to keep doing what we were doing. We want to be nuns. We want to just spend our lives hearing this teaching and deeply appreciating it. And so they quit their jobs. And their jobs were, they were the emperor's girlfriends. They were two of his favorite consorts. And so they sort of snuck away at night, wait till the emperor fell asleep and kind of snuck off. And then the next morning, Emperor Gotoba wakes up and he's like, hey, where are Matsumushi and Suzumushi? And, oh, they're nuns now. so they don't hang out with me anymore. He was not happy about that. And so the following year, so this happened in 1206, and then 1207, there was this great suppression of the Nembutsu community. And a few things happened. Several of Honen himself And several of his leading disciples were stripped of their monastic credentials. They were no longer allowed to be monks. And once they were basically, you know, defrocked in a sense, they were taken away, deprived of their status as a Buddhist monk, then they could be punished according to the whim of the emperor, basically, the laws of the country. And the emperor, so once they were stripped of their monastic credentials, you'll notice Andakubo and Judenbo, we don't have dates of birth, but we have their dates of death the same year. And so they were executed, beheaded, and Shinran and Honen were then sent into exile. And Honen was sent to Shikoku, to the area kind of around Kagawa and Ehime area of Shikoku, and Shinran was sent to the Echigo, which is now like Niigata province. So just a kind of quick... I need room for Shikoku if I'm going to talk about this. Kyushu. Okay, so Kyoto is here. So this is Kyoto, this roughly, so to speak. Honen was sent down here to this island. So this is like getting sent to the other end of the world at that time. Shinran is sent up here, and this is, there's all kinds of mountains between here and Kyoto. And so he actually had to take a boat, because you can't really travel at that time. You couldn't easily travel over land to get to this place. So he actually had to get on a boat and travel to this area called Echigo. And so en route to Echigo, so this is where, this time, this is where Shinran really starts to come into his own as a teacher. Because up until this point, he's always been with Honen. And he's always been a member of Honen's group. Whereas now he's separated from Honen. And so instead of always naturally deferring to Honen, he starts to share the teaching on his own. Not, you know, not necessarily of his own choosing, but he just finds himself in this situation where he's separated from all his friends and everybody he knows. He's got to make new friends, right? And so when you make new friends, you talk about what's important to you. And if you're Shinran, all you talk about is Amida Buddha, because that's what's really important to you. And other people start to hear this teaching, and they say, well, we've never heard anything about this. This is like cutting edge. You know, this is, you know, this is going from, you know, San Francisco or New York City to, you know, Wichita, Kansas or something like that. You know, this is like the cutting edge stuff. And all of a sudden, you know, they're sending this teaching out all over Japan. You know, this was sort of concentrated in Kyoto, but now it's going everywhere. And so Shinran starts, as he's traveling through this area en route to Echigo, which is where he has to go, he's naturally telling people about his teaching. You know, they see him, you know, they're like, well, who are you? You know, I used to be a Buddhist monk. Oh, really, that's interesting. You know, tell me about Buddhism. And then he kind of starts to develop a community of followers of his own. And one of those was a man by the name of Kunen. Kunen, who was a kind of a leading aristocratic person in this area, called Echizen. Echizen. So it's next to Echigo, where he would be sent. It's now Fukui, the Fukui prefecture of Japan. And Shinran develops a close relationship with this this follower, Kunen. And later, after, you know, time goes on, and Kunen has developed this community of his own, and Kunen says, you know, I'd really like one of your children to be my successor, to keep this community going. And so Shinran sends Kunen his third son, Dosho. He says, okay, you know, Dosho, you know, you're my third son, you know, I have a job for you, I have an assignment. You are to go to Fukui, go to Echizen, and be, you know, the successor to my good friend and Dharma companion Kunin. And so Dosho, as a good son, he goes and he says, okay, I'm going to be the number two here. And Dosho becomes the second generation leader of the Joshoji branch of Honganji. So remember I said that we have all these different branches of Jodo Shinshu, and so Joshoji is another of these branches. Now it's quite a bit smaller. I think they have like about 80 temples now. So it's much smaller. But one of the things that Dosho does that's quite interesting is he says, okay, you know what we're going to do for our liturgy? We are going to chant Shoshinge and Wasa. That's what we're going to do. We're going to chant the whole Shoshinge, and then we're going to chant a cycle of Wasa after that. And that's going to be our thing that we do. So this was Dosho is the person who's kind of credited with starting this in the Joshoji school. The Honganji school, which developed from Shinran's descendants, his other descendants, particularly his daughter and then his grandson were kind of instrumental in developing the later, and great-grandson were instrumental in developing the Honganji. And the dominant liturgy in the Honganji continued to be this Ojo Raisan that people had been doing with Honen. They're saying, well, you know, we'll do what Dad did. Dad never chanted his own stuff. Dad always chanted the Ojo Raisan, you know, which is what they did. You know, that was what Honen's group did. And Shinran always emphasized that I'm a disciple of Honen. He never said, I'm starting my own thing. It was only later generations that kind of these independent groups sort of centered around the identity of having Shinran as their founder developed. And so it wasn't until Denyo's time that the Honganji really embraces. Denyo is eight generations later in terms of the leadership. And he lived from 1415 to 1499. And Denyo was the one who said, okay, we're going to chant Shoshinge Wasan in the Honganji school, so our school. And as part of that project, so Denyo was known for kind of bringing all these different, there were all these little groups of Nembutsu people. They didn't really have a leader, or they were just kind of very localized. And Denyo said, you know, this teaching is going to die out if we don't organize and strengthen ourselves as an organization. So he brought everybody together. He brought all these little groups together and said, okay, we're all going to kind of get on the same page here in terms of our understanding of Shinran's teachings and in terms of what we do. And part of that, a big part of that, was that we're all going to chant Shoshinge and Wasa all together. That's going to be the thing that we do. And in order to make that possible, Denyo utilized a kind of new technology called the printing press. So he printed copies of Shoshinge Wasan, mass-produced them, and distributed them widely so that many people could get it quickly and as a way of kind of rolling out these changes and bringing everybody together. Up until that point, things were copied out by hand. You know, you got permission from your teacher, can I copy your writings? Your teacher gave you the book, you copied it out by hand, very painstakingly, and then you handed back the original when you were done. But Denyo said, no, we want to get this out to a lot of people fast. People, even people who can't write that well, but maybe can read a little bit, so we'll use the printing press. And that edition is called the Bunmei edition. That's the fifth year of the Bunmei era, well, 1473. Denyo kind of distributed that edition out there. And so there's a passage here from the episode, an episode from the life of Denyo that I've selected here to share with everyone this morning, because this, I think, shows us how Denyo used this chanting of Wasan, how this became a really central part of Denyo's practice and life of the Nembutsu. Denyo is here in Aronaijin also, just to the left of the central shrine image. So we have Shindan on the right and Benyo over on the left. Let's see, Sasaki-sensei, could I ask you to read the that recorded episode from Benyo's life on page 2? Begins with one day.
One day, at the time of service, Benyo Shoni forgot his turn in Jun-san. After retiring to the Southern Hall, he remarked, "The hymns which Shindan Shoni taught us were so wonderful that I forgot my turn in Jun-san. How sad it is," he commented, "that very few accept his exhortation and obtain birth in the pyramid."
Thank you. So Benyo really loved these wasan. They were so he's listening to him. We have this vision of him listening to the wasan as he's chanting. And he forgets that it's his turn to chant. He's so wrapped up in it. You know, everybody's like, you know, he's the big boss, so they can't, you know, they're sort of like waiting. And I've been there, this has happened. I mean, probably Sasaki-sensei's had a similar experience where people are chanting and it's somebody's turn and there's just this moment of dead silence where everybody's waiting for, you know, for somebody. Because it's done in this call and response sort of way, like the Ojo Rai-san, except the way that it's done is we chant six wasan at a time, and we'll each take turns. So you'll have six ministers in the Onaijin chanting, and each one will take a turn leading the first line of the wasan. If you go to a service at Honganji or a temple where you have multiple ministers, you know, you'll hear this. And so, you know, sometimes people is going around and like, oh, it's my turn. And then they have to start in. So this happened to Benyo himself because he was so kind of caught up in his appreciation of the teaching. So I want us to try to stay kind of on schedule here. So I think this would be a good time to take a break. And what I think we'll do is we'll have our break. I think we're scheduled for about a 15-minute break. And then we can come back and maybe we can do some questions at the start of the next session. Thank you. Yes?
It's kind of interesting that the Issei people call Jun-san is a common word for policeman.
Oh, really?
Jun-san is a policeman.
Yeah.
We have to be policemen.
Yeah. So we'll just have a brief gotcha before we break. Namanda, what's in 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 Namanda. Let's enjoy, please take some time to enjoy some refreshments. I think it's probably the work of a wild monkey.